This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 388.
Skydart and I are in a supposedly haunted bed and breakfast type place as we make our way across Canada. Did Comic-Con, went and performed at Just for Laughs in Montreal, and then said, let's take a few days off. I know, me! Rented a car, drove through Ottawa, and now we're in Kingston, which is a phenomenal town if you've never been through. I recommend Kingston, Ontario. We like it a lot. Food's good. Architecture is amazing. People are super nice. It's a good town. It's got history. History's good, isn't it? It is. Do I like to ask questions and answer them? Yes, I do. Also, I want to mention that Geek Week is coming up August 4th through 10th, which is essentially a themed week that YouTube has put together that we as the Nerdist Channel are producing with a bunch of incredible partners like Stan Lee and Machinima and Freddie W. and Felicia Day. And so go to our channel on YouTube, youtube.com/Nerdist, click subscribe, and then you'll see a bunch of themed programming around the week of August 4th. So that's that. And I want to thank Shutterstock.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Shutterstock is, you're going to find the perfect video for whatever creative project you're working on next. It's website, advertising, multimedia presentation, any kind of film project. Over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, 3D motion graphics, in pretty much any kind of digital format that you would possibly need. They're going to give you the asset you need to bring whatever your creative project is to the next level, so you don't have to go out and shoot the thing yourself. What if you're like, I need a duck standing on a car? Well, good luck engineering that. But with Shutterstock, you probably have a good chance of finding it. So use Shutterstock. They have amazing customer service. If you're having a tough time, 24-hour support all throughout the week. And they've got flexible pricing, too. So no credit card needed. Start an account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine your next project and what it could be like. Save video selections, you find your clip box. Then once you decide to purchase, then you're going to need a credit card, but use the offer code NERDIST7 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. 30% off new accounts. Use NERDIST7 and good luck finding that duck on a car. This episode is George R.R. Martin. I have to do it the Paul and Storm pirate way. Actually, if I were really being thorough, I would say George R.R. Martin, which I think we probably did one time in an hour-long marathon version of The Captain's Wife Lament, which is probably on YouTube somewhere with Paul and Storm, Will and I. But George did an amazing thing at Woodstock this year at Comic-Con where he came on stage and destroyed Paul and Storm's guitars. And I think Veronica Belmont took video of it and put it up on YouTube, but George was kind enough to sit down with us. In his hotel room, we went to the Palace du Georges. Is that a language? Probably not. And here you go, the Nerdist Podcast number 388 with the genius George R.R. Martin. Didn't do the pirate voice in the last one. Yar, welcome.
You have to say George.
I don't think I do have to say George.
Good gerb.
George?
Good gerb.
Thanks, Claire.
You're a haunted bird and breakfast.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey,
doing here?
We're going to talk just about, you know, chicks and stuff.
No. that'll get you in trouble.
Oh, sorry. Products.
We're talking about products. Wait, Jonah, that's way worse.
What?
No.
Bitches, I don't know. What are they?
Vicky, stop it.
You?
You're listening to the Mad Men Comedy Hour. George R. R. Martin, we're in your hotel room. We've invaded your hotel room. Which I was noticing, you have a really nice view. There's no evidence out of this side of the building that there's any type of convention of any sort.
No. They've given me the San Diego view.
You have the San Diego view. So out this is like, oh, you're on a nice vacation. And then the window on the other side of the building is, I have to walk through that?
Yes, well, no. I have to take a golf cart through that, I think. And, you know.
With a cow catcher on the front.
Saying, you know, clear the way.
That comes to plow.
Do people, I mean, this experience for you must be, I mean, you've been a long-time convention goer. You've been going to conventions for a long, I mean.
I've been going to conventions since there were conventions, especially comic book conventions. 1964, the first comic book convention ever held. New York City, run by Len Wein.
Uh-huh.
He was in high school. I was in high school and living in Bayonne, New Jersey. He ran the first comic book convention. It was a sleazy hotel in Greenwich Village. Saturday only. One day, it had a room about the size of my hotel room he had rented, and there were about 30 people there. So it's growing in some way. Steve Ditko showed up. Wow. And the other big guest was Fabulous Flo Steinberg. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Fabulous Flo. She was actually a secretary at Marvel at the time, but Stan Lee always talked about her as Fabulous Flo.
So she was a celebrity.
She was a celebrity. So she came, and Steve Ditko came. I don't think he's ever come to a convention since. We must have scared him, these 30 high school kids who were there to welcome him. But, Len told me that that I was the first person to sign up for it. So in that sense, I am the first comic fan.
Wow.
I am number one. My badge said number one because I was the first one to sign up. So
weirdly
all enough, this comes from me.
You're your offspring.
That's right.
Weirdly enough, though, the same amount of comic books at that first comic book convention than there are now.
Hey!
The same amount of people here for comic books.
Yeah. I mean, it really has become pop culture cons, which...
It has, yes.
Which some people, you know, I hear sometimes like, oh man, it's not just about comics. I go, yeah, but, you know, because it's more infused into pop culture, we get a Game of Thrones, or we get a Joss Whedon Avengers movie, or we get, you know, like, it's, I think it's nice, actually. Do you wish it were like the old days?
Not really. I mean, there's a complicated issue here. The general and the personal. Of course, I'm a science fiction guy, too. Besides, I started as a comic fan, but I've written science fiction and fantasy and novels and screenplays and all that for many years. And I went to my first World Science Fiction Convention in 1971. So the comic conventions first, starting with Lens in 64, and then in 71 I went to the World Science Fiction Convention in Boston, and I've been going to those ever since. And Worldcon, as it's generally called, it moves to a different city every year. And it was the center of the science fiction fantasy universe. It was the biggest convention in the world. It was the gathering of all the tribes, not the book readers. Books were always central to it, but you had television, film, and you had some comic book guys, and you had gaming, although in those days there were no video games and all that. You had all of that would come together, costumers, etc., Filk singers at Worldcon, and it grew. It was like 2,000 when I started going, and it grew to like 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000. And then a few comic book conventions started, and as I said, there were like 30 people at the first one. They were pretty small, and this one started in San Diego. But up to about the mid-80s, Worldcon was still the big convention. And in 1984, that was really the turning point. The 1984 Worldcon in Los Angeles drew 8,000 people. And that panicked the people running Worldcon, saying, oh, it's getting too big. And these people are coming in and they don't read the books. You know, they're coming in and they're not book reading people. Yeah, and we don't want to, so let's stop advertising so much. Let's stop doing that. And San Diego Comic-Con, which was going at the time, was actually smaller. I mean, when Worldthousand was 8,000, it was only like 4,000 or 5,000. But at that point, Worldcon pulled back and said, we don't want to do that anymore. And San Diego stepped to the breach and said, okay, we'll do it. Everybody's welcome here, you know. You don't have to read the books. You can be anything. You don't have to be a comic book fan. And since then, of course, you see the results. I mean, San Diego is 150,000 people, and Worldcon is still stuck at about 3,000, 4,000. And has become, I don't know, it's still the center for the people who read novels and science fiction and fantasy novels. It's still where the Hugo Awards are given out, but it's become less and less relevant and more, not only San Diego, but Dragon Con, the New York City Comic Con, C2E2 in Chicago. All of these are gigantic shows compared to the World Con. And there's part of me that regrets it. It's the old fart part of me that still likes the idea of Worldcon being the center. You know, Worldcon used to be, you know, in 1977, there was a Star Wars, a year before Star Wars came out, they had a display. George Lucas had a display at the Kansas City Worldcon where Mark Hamill was there in a room full of props, and people were coming in and saying, what the hell is this? Oh, a new movie coming out next year. You'll like it.
And, we'll see.
Yeah.
Good luck with that. That looks dumb.
This
yeah.
yeah,
right. Was that a sword made out of light? That's stupid.
You know, Christopher Reeve showed up to accept his Hugo for the Hugo for Superman, as well as the best dramatic presentation. It used to be something that, you know, the world of media and film and all that really cared about. Now they don't. You know, by and large, it's all turned into San Diego. And San Diego's done a great job for it. I mean, this is an incredible convention. The size of it is daunting. I can't imagine. I mean, I have a great time here, but without trying to sound too egomaniacal, it's because I'm a VIP.
Yeah,
I get golf courts to take me where I am. I go in the secret entrances that isn't available to the fans.
Where are these secret entrances?
Not for you. Not for you.
It's actually a pneumatic tube system from George's hotel room, and then he just appears in Hall H.
That's what that door is.
And then back.
Yeah. I can't imagine what this experience is like for, you know, equivalent to the 13-year-old kid I was in 1964 when I went to Lynn's convention.
Right.
Someone who just pony ups his money and comes to the convention, and then you're standing in lines for hours and hours, and maybe you don't get into any of the panels you actually want to see, and you can't. I mean, I don't know. They do a great job. People seem to have fun, but boy, I would not like to go to this convention as a fan. But I love coming here as a pro and a guest and doing that kind of thing. It's exciting. It's exhilarating.
What was that first Comic-Con in 1964? What was it? Was it basically just, would you as a, like, obviously artist, but did people just bring, like, a box of comics to trade? I mean, was it trading, or were you buying stuff, or was
it
more?
It was all in one room, so there was no dealer's room or parties, right? It was all, like, in a room this size, and there were a few people who brought boxes of old comic books, cardboard boxes, and they were trading back and forth and selling them. You know, it was, and we were shocked because, you know, those 10-cent comic books, people were selling them for like a quarter. They were like profiteering. They were getting 2.5, and, you know, people were saying,
maybe 45 cents.
Wait a minute, this is a 10-cent comic book and it's used. It should be like cheaper now. There you raise the price on it.
Did you foresee?
I remember like a couple years later, a copy of Action Number 1 at like the third Comic-Con in New York, which I also went to. A copy of Action Number 1 sold for $100. It made all the news stations.
What a rip.
These people paid $100 for a comic book. What the hell is wrong with these people?
Did you? Okay, so when that started to happen, you must have. But did you foresee that kind of like aftermarket, secondhand, vintage collectors thing? Did you think that would happen, or were you just a surprise?
Yeah, I did think it would happen, actually. By the time I saw that happening, I got started smart. So I was, you know, when like X-Men Number 1 came out and Avengers Number 1 came out, I bought multiple copies. So, you know. And then, unfortunately, I sold those multiple copies, you know, back in the kind of late 70s when I had a year where I needed some money. So I still got pretty good, you know. I bought them for 12 cents and I sold them for $100 each or something like that. But now, of course, they're $10,000 each or whatever the hell they are.
You can buy them back. you can probably track those down and buy them back. So then,
but I did see, you know, you could already see by the 60... 65, 66, 67 that this was happening and it was going to continue to happen. You know, I had no idea where the roof was, though, yeah. And I still don't know. Have we hit the roof? Are these things going to continue to appreciate forever? I don't know. I don't know.
I can't imagine. They have to take over all of San Diego.
Yeah.
They're running out of space.
They're running out of space. They're running out of space in hotel rooms. Yeah. I mean, there's only so many people that this small little peninsula can hold.
Yeah.
So it couldn't be that much more.
Weren't they trying to get money to, like, expand the convention center?
They're doing that, yeah. Oh, because people are trying to lure this away. Las Vegas wants to take it over. Los Angeles wants to take it over. So.
Yeah.
They got to keep bidding for it, but I actually can't. I've been to conventions in, you know, Los Angeles, Anaheim, which is the big, you know, convention. Anaheim, you're in Anaheim. You know, the convention center is huge, but you walk out and you're in Anaheim.
You're in Anaheim.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's what I like about it being in San Diego. It's still a pretty cool city.
It is,
you know,
yes.
For being in a Southern California.
And you got the gas lamp district here, which is much cooler than Anaheim.
Yeah, exactly.
We got downtown Disney, guys.
Main Street.
I mean, come on.
Like San Diego Comic-Con, basically, it's like it's Los Angeles' corporate retreat. It's like everyone that works in the industry, it's like this is where we're gonna take a trip. Everyone's let's all go down.
Yeah.
And do trust falls.
I think Vegas would be a huge mistake. I think Vegas would first of all, the number...
best mistake, you mean?
No. It's too much. It'd be too much. It's sensory overload. And the number of costume-related heat stroke deaths that would occur in Las Vegas...
There's already enough here.
It's bad enough. Yeah, I just don't
see
that.
Yeah, that would be pretty bad, yeah.
Yeah, it just feels kind of gross. Where's the... what's the best city you've been to a convention? And what do you like? Where do you like to go?
Well, that's a complicated question. It depends on what you're considering. I mean,
topography.
a lot of conventions, you know, you never leave the hotel or the convention center. You know, so there may be a great city around, but you never see it.
Right.
You're doing panels and discussions and so forth. Sometimes you get a badly run convention, like the World Science Fiction Convention moves to a different city every year, so you see a lot of cities.
Sure.
And they have different characteristics. I mean, it has been in Anaheim a few years. That's why I know Anaheim. They big Anaheim Convention Center and things next to it. And that's a wonderful physical layout. So when you're actually at the convention, you know, the hotels are right next to the convention. It's easy to walk from one to the other. And for the parties at night, they got this hotel with a big open atrium, you know, and that's really pleasant. All the parties sort of merge into one party, and you're drifting around the pool, and you know, it's very nice. But then when you want to go out to eat, you're in Anaheim, and
again.
it's terrible. On the other hand, like a couple decades ago, they had a Worldcon in New Orleans, and it was one of the worst-run Worldcons ever. They just completely screwed up everything, and people couldn't find their panels and all that. But nobody cared because they were in New Orleans.
That's right.
They would go out, and then the French Quarter was right there, so you go into the French Quarter, and the food was fabulous, and the drink was fabulous, and so forth. Next year, Worldcon's in London. London is very cool. Glasgow is cool.
It's all over the world. Then.
It goes all over the world. Yeah. It was in Japan. Japan a few years ago.
Oh,
and
nice.
Finland is bidding for Helsinki. Is bidding for the 3 years in the future.
Oh, wow.
The city's bid for the right
like
to hold the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How many panels are you doing while you're here?
Just two.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. I'm doing the Game of Thrones panel, of course, in Hall H, which will be huge. And then I have a comic book that just debuted, Avatar's adaptation of my novella, The Skin Trade. So
cool.
That's making its debut here, and we're doing a panel on Sunday. So that'll be a small little panel. So
yeah, Skin Trade. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually about comic books, so.
Do you think in a situation like that, because of how big Game of Thrones is, there's going to be like people asking questions?
Does it get in the way?
Yeah. You...
They may. I'll find out.
Yeah. I've seen panels before where it's just like, you know, they're there for a show, but like one person is from some other bigger entity.
Then it's sort of up to the moderator to be like, hey guys, this is about Skin Trade. No Game of Thrones questions. That's in the Game of Thrones panel. You know, like go ask those questions then. But sometimes when people are like, this is my one chance, I gotta do it.
Yeah, and that's in a relatively small room. It'll house a couple hundred people. The Game of Thrones panel is in Hall H. There'll be 7,000 people there, and people line up. They start lining up before the panel begins to ask their questions. So
last year there was an accident, right? Because everyone trying to line up for Hall H. Everyone was like trying to squeeze into this area, and a girl
was like outside on the street because you couldn't get the line that you got hit, right?
Yep.
They should really handle that.
I think they did. I think everything's. I think they organized it a lot better this year. So I think it's all gonna. I think
just
it's all
takes
gonna be okay.
One hit and run.
People do camp out. People camp out on the street right outside the Bayfront, like all night long. But I think that sounds
fun. I don't want to critic. I think
they just don't have hotel rooms.
The people who run this convention do an incredible job. I mean, compared to something like Worldcon, this thing, you know, runs magnificently. But because it just because it has become so popular, they have some insurmountable problems. They have 150,000 people, you know, signing up for this convention, and the biggest hall sits 7,000. And you know, so people who want to come to the big panels, that's why the 150,000 people are here, right? So they can see these stars and all that, and yet they can't, they pay their tickets, they can't actually get in, you know, 143,000 people.
There's still 143,000 people.
I can alleviate the problem. Have a panel at Petco.
The Petco panel at Petco Park.
You can sit 75,000 in there.
It'll happen someday.
That's an idea.
Yeah.
Every answer sounds like the Lou Gehrig speech.
I'd like to know. No, it was about red wedding.
Or the Beatles at Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we don't really have time to ask questions.
We're sweating panels. They can't hear ourselves.
I wanted to ask you about Superworld because I played. I was a big D&D guy since there was D&D, and I never. I remember there were a couple other iterations of our, like when D&D sort of popped up. Then there was like Boot Hill, and then there was like a 007 kind of a like a spy version. But Superworld, I never played, but it sounded awesome.
It was we had a lot of fun with it. It led to my Wildcard series. You know, it probably cost me at least two novels because I played it obsessively and effectively for like 2 years. And, you know, instead of writing, I'd be inventing, because I was a game master, inventing more villains and plots and things like that. And we were playing like 3 times a week, and we were all, my little group was all young then, so we would play till like 4 in the morning, and then we would spend the next 2 hours doing a postmortem of the game we had just finished playing.
An after show, if you will.
Yes, and then it would be like dawn, and we would drive back to our houses and sleep the next day. Well, a lot of writers, we didn't have to work for a living.
So you liked being game master versus being playing a character in the game?
I like both of them, but yeah, I did like being a game master of that one. That was pretty cool.
What was your favorite character?
Six.
Well, you know, I was creating the villains, so some of the characters in that game went on to become Superworld characters, like Vic Milan's Captain Trips and Walter Don Williams' Modular Man, and so forth. They made the transition well.
So I was reading about the game, and so from what I understand, the mechanics, you basically, it was similar to D&D, but you basically would get, like, just slight modifications of superpowers, but it wasn't as specific as, like, it would say, like, oh, you get a radiation blast, like, you would get a radiation blast modification, but it would say, and it comes through your laser eyes. Like, it wasn't...
No. I don't know where you got that. That's wrong.
The internet. That's why it's wrong.
It was a point-based system. You had a, you know, you had a base of how many points you got, and you used them to buy powers. You know, super speed or flight or whatever it was, and there were levels and things like that. But then you could get more points by taking on disadvantages. So, you know, we at first when we created the characters, when we started playing it, we didn't know what we were doing, so we just, you know, created characters. People, you know, like, would create a superhero who had like 7 different powers. You know, he could fly, and he had laser vision, and he had some super strength and all that stuff, but you're spending your points, you only got like 1 or 2 levels of each of these. So he could do like 7 different things, but he couldn't do any of them really well. And then you
Jack of all trades.
Later on, we figured out, okay, this guy can throw lightning bolts. He can throw really big lightning bolts that do like 40d6 damage.
Oh, Jesus.
And that's what. But then you needed defenses. You had to have a force field or impenetrable armor, and there were levels of, well, my armor is proof against kinetic damage, but it's not proof against radiation damage. Then you were vulnerable to the guys who had radioactive powers or electrical powers. So you had a way where you're going to put your points. But you could always get more points, as I said, by taking disadvantages. So we used to say that, you know, if if someone who looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger or Superman showed up and as a villain, nobody was worried about him. But, you know, if like a thalidomide-based dwarf came, everybody ran in terror because they knew he would have really awesome powers.
Oh, shit, he's got a flipper arm.
He can vaporize you instantly.
It's thalidomide. Run! And then what I think was kind of interesting was that it sounds like you guys were sort of crafting the game mechanics as you were playing at the same time.
Yeah, in a sense we were, yeah. But our group, I mean, when Melinda Snodgrass was in it, Vic Milan, Walter John Williams, you know, John Miller, a lot of the people went on to write for Wild Cards, and they were all writers, and they're all very imaginative, so it really was role-playing, you know. It was not... We went through entire nights where nobody rolled the dice. It was all just playing our characters. It was like improv theater, and it could be very funny or very exciting, where we were just, you know, playing scenes out. And some of those scenes actually later appeared in the Wild Card books.
Oh wow!
So it was fun, and that's still my favorite kind of role playing, is the role playing part of the role playing, not the rolling of the dice and the you know, the fighting things kind of, but meeting with other characters and all that.
And actually just being like it's life, but they're actually characters with these enhancements. So do you think the Wild Card series just sort of being, I think, much more of a kind of realistic approach to superheroes, does it seem sort of antithetical to the rest of the 80s, which seemed like a very idealized period of time where everything's shiny and everything is perfect, but then, you know, you have a much more realistic portrayal of...
No, Wild Cards actually came along at exactly the same time as Watchmen and Dark Knight.
Oh, 87, 86, 87.
Yeah, it was all the same period. So it was something in the water there where I think a lot of people were independently saying, you know, we love these comic books, but some of the conventions of them are silly, or, you know, let's do a more realistic take on them and see how they went out. And I've always found it fascinating to compare those three approaches, you know, particularly Watchmen and Wild Cards, because, you know, both of those were multiple. I mean, Dark Knight was just one, just a new take on Batman, but Watchmen and Wild Cards were both kind of reinventing the superhero genre with a large cast of characters, and Alan Moore and our writers on hand took very different approaches to it, but they both arrived more, you know, more realistically.
Did you...
I mean, more basically threw out the superpowers. You know, Dr. Manhattan is the only one of the Watchmen who has actual superpowers. The
right.
rest of them are just like
good
Batman
fighters.
Guys. Yeah, they dress up in costumes and they go out and fight crime and all that. We took quite the opposite approach. We kept the superpowers, but we threw out they dress up in costumes and fight crime. You know, because we decided that was the realistic, you know, our fundamental question is, well, what would happen if you got a superpower, you know? And ask yourself that. I mean, what if all of you were hit by a cosmic rays as you left this room and you all developed different superpowers? Would your first thought be to buy a spandex costume and fight crime?
Well, here at Comic-Con, yes.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, you probably all have spandex costumes here anyway.
You've just described the wet dream of everyone in there. They walk out, get hit by cosmic rays, and they're already in the spandex.
Right.
Like, oh my god, I was waiting for
toxic
this.
Toxic waste dump, eh? I'll be right back.
I just got cancer. It's not a superpower at all. It's bullshit. Fuck you, comic books. But the approach of having a bunch of different writers and essentially kind of weaving their stories together, was that exciting for you also as a fan to be like, oh, I can't wait to see what someone else writes and where they go with it and where I can build on that? That kind of collaboration?
Yeah, to an extent, yeah. It's always fun when I invite a new writer into Wild Cards and they bring in a new character and seeing them interact with the other older characters. But yeah, and seeing the characters spark off each other, the writers spark off each other. I mean, when it works well, it's you know, like a jam session between great musicians or something, where they're sitting around and they're jamming off each other's riffs and all that, and that's great. Now, mind you, it doesn't always work well, and that's my job as editor, is, you know, sometimes you get clashing egos, or you get the famous creative differences, where people want to do different things, and, you know, sometimes you have cases where two writers like each other a lot, and they have a great time making their characters hate each other and have a feud. And, you know, on the other hand, you may get discussion where two writers actually don't like each other very much. And, you know, so I have to keep all this in line as editor. And, you know, what? Sometimes you do get that great jam session. But sometimes, you know, the entire orchestra is playing... I can't get no satisfaction, except there's one guy who wants to play Buffalo Gal, won't you come out tonight? And it doesn't necessarily gel. So, you know, that's why I get the big bucks as editor.
Nice. Or do you actually kind of go in and sort of play personalities, going, well, this guy likes to do this kind of thing, and this person likes to do this kind of thing, and so I'll, you know, sort of assign these different parts of the story to...
Yeah, no, it's I mean, I'm aware of all the writer's strengths and weaknesses, of course, but I come up with a general overplot frequently in consultation with some of the other writers,
yeah.
And then I say, okay, well, this is going to be, you know, this is going to be overplot of this book. This is what is happening. You know, aliens have invaded, and they land on Tuesday, and, you know, they look like giant squids, and et cetera, et cetera. And what do we do? And then I take solicitations for however many stories. I've decided I'm going to take 8 stories. We got like 40 members in the consortium, so I get more than 8 proposals, and I go through and say who's in and who's out and which stories would work well together and which stories kind of duplicate each other and all of that stuff, so...
You're still basically the game master.
Yeah, pretty much.
I want to talk a little bit about... you worked on Twilight Zone, the new Twilight Zones.
The second of the 4 Twilight Zones, yes.
The second...
Twilight Zone 2, as we call it, yes. Not the one with Rod Serling, that was Twilight Zone 1.
That was Twilight Zone 1, yeah. You did the 80s.
We were
the
revival, the mid-80s network, CBS network version.
Right.
Then later that was succeeded by, after we were canceled, they wanted more episodes for syndication. So they moved it to Canada with like a quarter of our budget, and they did Twilight Zone 3, which is often bundled with Twilight Zone 2 in syndication packages. But that was a different show with a different staff. Joe Straczynski was on that staff.
Oh!
He was Twilight Zone 3. And then they went away for 20 years, and they brought back a brief Twilight Zone 4 that lasted like 4 episodes a couple years ago.
But one of the ones that I read that you wrote, and I actually remembered, which was the it was the Camelot one.
Last Defender of Camelot.
Yeah.
Roger Zelazny's short story. I did the adaptation. Yeah.
Which I always loved because it basically sort of portrayed Merlin as a dick.
Well, that was Roger. I mean, I did a faithful version, as faithful as I could do, of Roger's short story, which was brilliant, yeah.
Yeah. And then Jonah is a huge Beauty and the Beast fan.
Big fan of Beauty and the Beast. I watched it all the time.
But you're male.
I know. I found that out.
He's like the Beast.
Now at school. He asked, why does Beauty and the Beast...
What are you talking about?
Never chick.
Then you're just trying to scrape your Beauty and the Beast sticker off. I don't know what to put this on here.
Yeah, even like a buddy of mine, like we made this... like, you know, we had this web show, and there was an episode. It was kind of like a serialized thing, or not serialized, but like, you know, it was like a Retro Diaries kind of like parody. Sure. And it was like a sexy radio show. And then like one of the letters that we got was basically just Beauty and the Beast, where it was like an under. Yeah, but yeah, I'm a big fan.
Any good Ron Perlman stories? Everyone I talk to that's worked with Ron Perlman always has one good Ron Perlman story.
I don't know if I have any stories, but working with Ron was great. He was a great actor. He was easy to work with. He was delightful.
Yeah,
he's completely different from Vincent, of course. His personality is much closer to Hellboy than Vincent, but he could do the Vincent voice and the makeup. You know, it took him 4 hours to get into that makeup and then 1 hour at the end of the day to get out of it. So that's every working day, add 5 hours to it. But he was amazing.
How do you like the process of adapting to a teleplay, of trying to port something over to television?
Well, I've seen it from both sides. I've been adapted. I've done adaptations myself. You know, television has limitations that books don't have of budget and shooting time. You know, you have to get it, produce an hour of film and within a certain parameter, 7 days on Beauty and the Beast. Longer on, you know, Game of Thrones, which has a considerably higher budget, and we only do 10 episodes a year as opposed to 22. So that's a slightly different parameter. But there's always there's always limitations, so you have to make choices, and sometimes they're hard choices. That being said, I also believe, which maybe is not a popular opinion in Hollywood, that you owe a certain fidelity to the original source material and to the fans and readers of that source material. And while you have to make some changes for practical reasons, mm-hmm. you should never make extraneous changes just because you think you know better than the original writer, you know. If you're adapting Spider-Man, you should stay as close to Stan Lee as possible. You shouldn't try to improve Spider-Man because you think you know better than Stan Lee, because you probably don't. And if you look at all of the Marvel movies, the ones that stay closest to the original material, the strongest, the ones where people have gotten carried away and introduced a lot of extraneous changes are weaker, and sometimes disastrously weaker.
Right.
And I think that's not just true of Marvel, that's true of anything. You know, don't mess with the original material. There's lots of stories out there. If you want to make a different story, make a different story, and make it your own story, make it an original. You know, you don't have to trash something. There's plenty of room for different variants on some of these basic ideas. But if you're gonna adapt something, you're adapting it because it already has a name and a reputation. It already has fans. You're getting the advantage of that. You're getting people who love this character or people who love this particular story are going to come and see your movie or your television show because they love the original. What they want to see is the original translated to a new medium. They don't want to see a new story that the screenwriter came up with just sharing a few basic elements of the old story.
But I think that's why it's helpful that, you know, you're involved in your own adaptation.
Yes.
Because, you know, the idea of what the source material is can be sort of subjective in some senses to fans who they'll read text on a page and then get this, you know, get this image in their mind of what it is. And then someone else translates, they're going, no, that's not what it is at all. Like the audience like comes in with a lot of preconceived notions. So it seems like you have a little bit more of an untainted adaptation because it all came from your head.
Yeah, I mean, I think my involvement is part of it, but some of it is also due to the fact that David Benioff and Dan Weiss, who are the showrunners, who are doing most of the scripts and all that, love my books and the original material, and although they've made changes for some of the practical reasons we've talked about, they do want to do my story adapted to a different medium. They don't want to do a different story. And some of that is not by accident. I mean, when the books came out and the books achieved bestsellerdom, a lot of people from Hollywood took notice and started coming around. And I got offers and inquiries and phone calls, and my agents got letters about people who were interested in doing it as like a feature film or something. And I had meetings with some of these people, and I said, no, you know, that's something you can always say no. So in some ways I sometimes get impatient with novelists who don't say no, who say yes. They take the dump truck full of money and then the movie comes out and it's completely changed and they complain, or, you know, they denounce it, or, you know, why didn't you just say no?
Right.
You know, you didn't have to do that. You know that Hollywood will change things. You can always say no. You have the power at the time when they come to you, before you sign any of the contracts, you can control it. You can ask for creative control, you can ask for script approval. Now you may not get these things, you may lose the deal. But, you know, if you're J.K. Rowling, you can get everything you want, you know. If you're me, you can get some of the things you want. If you're some guy who's just published his first novel and Hollywood wants it, maybe you want the dump truck full of money, then more than you want that kind of thing. But, you know, that's the stage to do it. Don't take it. I don't know. There's something that seems hypocritical about me, about taking all the money and making the deal and then trashing the movie that comes out
right
at the end. You know, and that bothers me.
But
as a fan of other people's work, I can trash their movies when they change. I don't.
Do it. Yeah.
Well, that's why I think, you know, like the moving over to television and working in that medium of television is when you kind of have, when you personally sort of have this kind of game master mentality, but then going into a business where a lot of weird decisions are made that you don't have control over, and you know that, and then it affects the creative. Like a lot of weird business decisions get made that affect the creative. So how do you reconcile those two things?
Well, it's not a coincidence that I'm back writing mostly novels again. I mean, you know, in novels I control everything. I decide exactly what goes in there. So if there's bad things in my novels, it's my fault. And if there's things you don't like, it's my fault. It's my decision. I can't blame anyone else. That's the only thing I do control. But I do like having that creative control of my stories. That's something that's very hard to get in Hollywood. I mean, yeah, you can aspire to it. You can be, you know, if you're successful enough, and you can be Steven Spielberg or in the realm of motion pictures or you know, a Dick Wolf or Stephen Bochco in his heyday or someone in the realm of television where you've had a lot of hits and you get a lot of credit and you can pretty well do the things you want to do, but it's hard to achieve that. And for everyone who has that, there's 10,000 who are constantly having to fight and make compromises and losing some of these battles.
That's interesting, something you just said about, because you were talking about having creative control, and I think a lot of people want creative control, but you also were like, hey, if something's not good, it's my fault. I think there's a bigger issue of creative responsibility that you have to, that I think is kind of fun.
Yeah.
That you do get to say, like, yep, that's all me, because at least you don't feel compromised, or at least you can't be like, I shouldn't have given in on that thing, and I did, and it sucked, and I'm sorry. You know, it all stops at your feet, which I think fans kind of appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, sad fact is a lot of Hollywood runs off fear. People, you know, there's a lot of money involved. People are very afraid to make the wrong decision. I think particularly motion pictures. That's why so many of them don't get made. Because if you greenlight a movie and, you know, you're an executive and you greenlight a movie and then it flops, you know, it could cost you your job, it could cost you your career, because you get the blame for that. So you see a lot of people running around trying to avoid taking the blame.
Yeah, especially now in the movie business, where they're like, well, to put a movie in a theater really should be $100 to $150 million, because that above that line is where movies really make a lot of money. And so there's just, you know, there's so much at risk. Oh, was that cocaine?
Not yet.
Oh, okay.
I thought I heard about that.
Which, you know, I don't know, frankly, is too much money. It shouldn't cost that much, but I'm not going to change that by just saying these things, you know, but
it just takes one person, George. Come on.
Yeah, let's do it. Did you, when you started writing Song of Ice Fire, did you ever think, you know, someday I want to adapt this into something else? I mean, it was a good 11-year chunk. I know you said people approached you, but
it'll never happen. I mean, I started Ice and Fire coming out of 10 years in television on Twilight Zone and Beauty and the Beast, and 5 years of development hell trying to get a series going. And I was constantly being told my scripts were too big and too expensive. And, I, you know, at that point I went back and wrote Ice and Fire. I said, well, if I pardon my French, but fuck this. I want to write something as big as my imagination. I don't want to worry about budget. I don't worry. I'm going to have a cast of thousands. I'm going to have giant battles. I'm going to have, you know, special effects and dragons and dire wolves and 700-foot-tall walls of ice and armies of zombies. And, you know, I don't care if it's producible or not. It's producible on the page, man. It's just your imagination in the picture. So there's no limitations on the page. And this will never be adapted, but I don't care. So there it is. And at that time, I started it, even beyond the scale of it, it was unadaptable because it was epic fantasy. I mean, this was before the Peter Jackson movies. Nobody did epic fantasy. You couldn't do an epic fantasy movie. You know, Lucas had tried with Willow, and it had flopped, and nobody had touched it since. But, you know, that all changed with Lord of the Rings and Peter Jackson's, sure, you know, great success. And suddenly people said, oh, well, we can do epic fantasy. Initially just in film, and hopefully Game of Thrones is broken through the same way in television, and now Hollywood, which is very imitative, a lot of people are scrambling and optioning other epic fantasy series and developing those and developing more historical series. We're seeing a great rebirth of those with shows like The Borgias and The Tudors and Da Vinci's Demons and so forth, and I love historical fiction too, so all this is great with me. So I get tired of cop shows and lawyer shows. You know, how many more cop shows can we have here?
As many as there are cops.
I'd say partner with Dick Wolf to do like a medieval magical Law and Order. Like some sort of like Law and Order in some yeah. kind of a realm.
That would be good, yeah. Law and Order Carcassonne.
Yeah, what is it? I think it would be like, it's a medieval procedural. Like
yeah, okay. no Law and Order DVU.
Actually,
victim unit.
To be fair, we have two of those now. We have Copper.
We do have Copper, yeah, BBC American.
And
Copper.
We have Ripper Street.
Ripper Street, both BBC American. Yeah. No, I guess that's true. I guess that's totally
so
true.
So we're getting this thing. We don't have it, you know. There are a couple good series of Roman mysteries out there that they could adapt. John Mannix Roberts' SPQR series and Stephen Saylor's Gordianus series about private detectives solving crimes in ancient Rome in the Roman Republic. That would be
cool. That sounds really cool.
That would be awesome. Although, when you're talking about, like, I guess I would want to see some sort of a deity element in that. That it wouldn't just be, well, it's like Law and Order, but they're wearing togas. You know, like I would really want to see yeah, some.
That's just a sketch.
That is just a sketch. Yeah, that's just a sketch. It's not a full thing. And I think you're sort of at that point where I think the fans almost take a little bit of ownership over you and your work. And you know, I know people would give you shit. And
some of them take complete ownership.
Complete ownership. Yeah. Of them. Yeah. Not only, I'm sure, like story wise, like, well, what are you talking about? How can you do that? But if, you know, if they think you took too much time between books and you're like, hey, I'm a guy and I want to write other things sometimes, that has to be okay, you know? I mean, did you ever expect that relationship with the fans to sort of become kind of a runaway snowball?
No, I didn't expect it because I'd never done anything like this before. I mean, until Ice and Fire, although I'd had a long career, I'd written short stories and I'd written standalone novels. So a novel like Fever Dream or The Army in Red comes out, and it's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's a novel, you read it, it's over, you know. Occasionally you get a letter, someone would like a sequel, but if the story lends itself to sequels, but it's not an ongoing story, and no one is particularly waiting for the next one. No one is counting the days between books. So I could, you know, write a novel and then do other stuff, work in television for 10 years between one novel and the other novel, and no one seem to care much, but with an ongoing story, I've discovered, yeah, there are some people who care a lot. Now, mind you, I get 100 emails saying, take your time, we don't care when they come out, as long as they're good, you know, don't let anybody rush you. Very supportive, nice letters. But after 100 letters like that, I will get one email saying, you know, fuck you, write faster.
Big fan!
Yeah, I'm your number one fan, you know. Why are you not getting out the books, you lazy git, you? Why are you writing this other shit? No one cares about your other shit. I mean, people have actually said that to me.
People really do say shit like that. They really do say shit like that. Do you kind of get mentally prepared to write a new book, or does it just kind of hit you one day, like, today's the day I start, or do you have to prepare for it, or what's your, do you have to feel it, or do you just dive in when you have time?
I don't know, like, either of those. I mean, I've been writing these books pretty much constantly. I mean, I started in 91, but I did put it aside for a few years. Since I've read it in 94, I've been almost constantly working on it, and there's almost always been a book in progress, because even when I finish a book, usually there are like some chapters that are finished that I've removed from that book and decided to save to the next book. So I already have like a 100-page start before I really begin a book. So that's been true certainly the last few books in this series. So there's never a period where that I remember where I'm just starting from like page one and I have nothing on the book. It's like the minute one is finished, another one is going. But I do have a lot of distractions and other things as well, and yeah, some fans don't understand that either, you know. I mean, the job of being a writer, the career of being a writer, involves more than just writing. I mean, maybe it shouldn't, but, you know, I know there are writers who are just basically hermits, but these days publishers expect you to do things like our interview here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's This is not the only interview I'm doing at Comic-Con.
What?
I'm doing a number of interviews
at
Comic-Con.
This is bullshit.
Don't.
How dare you? You hurt Jonah's feelings.
And
that's all right, Big J.
I get invitations to go to conventions, and, you know, yes, I enjoy going to conventions, but a lot of it is also business. It's promotion. Sure. They send me on book tours that last a month, and then after I get back from that book tour, then my British publishers will come over to Britain. We want you to do a book tour. We have the new book coming out. And, you know, it's like an actor who does a movie, and then you have to do the talk show circuit to promote the movie. And there are some fans who just really don't understand that doing the interviews and doing the tours and doing the signing appearances is all part of the job of being a writer in 21st century America. It's not just sitting in your garret with your quill and preparing literary masterpieces here. So,
how do you write now? Do you have a program, or do you write in a notebook, or has it changed?
No, I've been writing on a computer since 1982, and pretty much using the same word processing program, WordStar, which I still use. I have a DOS computer that I write on with WordStar 4.0.
Wow. You're not worried about that at all?
I'm worried about. I have a Windows computer too that I surf the internet with and get my email with and do all of that stuff. That's the one I worry about. I mean, Ty, who's sitting over there, my assistant, is my computer guy, and I'm constantly having to yell out, "Ty, the computer's doing something weird." But it's always the Windows computer that's doing something weird. It's never the DOS computer. DOS is stable as a rock, and you know, nothing. Nothing really ever goes wrong with it. I've had friends working with Word or Windows who've lost, like, novels or something because they get some virus and it does that. Nothing happens with DOS or WordStar. And WordStar is a wonderfully unhelpful program that it does exactly what I want. At no point does a dancing paperclip come up, or at no point do I type something.
You really better update your Windows.
Something different comes on the screen because, you know, it decides that if I type a lowercase letter, I get a lowercase letter, where Windows is always, like, making it uppercase.
Yeah.
If I wanted uppercase, I would have typed it uppercase. I wanted lowercase, and all of that stuff. So.
Good morning.
Hi. You're lucky. DOS is a girlfriend no one will try to steal. You're all right.
And WordStar was, I remember, coming on 8 floppy disks, 3.25 floppies.
Wow.
I remember WordStar very well.
Yeah, WordStar is great. Stuff. It's good, you know.
You save stuff to a floppy drive?
I have mirrored hard drives, so everything is automatically saved to the second hard drive. But I also do have floppy disks.
Yeah.
Well, they're not floppy anymore. They're the hard little ones.
Yeah.
That I save it to. So.
Can you teach writing, do you think? I know you've taught in the past. Can you teach writing, or can you get someone to get to a place where they can access that?
You can't teach talent, but you can teach craft.
Oh, good.
You can teach craft and professionalism and the other aspects of having a career than just talent. So when I go to Clarion, you know, you can almost tell who's the most talented people, and they may not necessarily going to be the ones that, I mean, those classes are pre-selected, mind you. They get, thank you, hundreds of applicants, and they take 20. So everybody in there is talented to some degree, but some of them are amazingly talented, but they're not necessarily the ones who are going to have the best careers, because you also do need the craft and discipline, and you have to consult yourself in a fairly professional manner, and you have to keep at it. That's one of the things I teach. You know, this is writing is not a profession for anyone who needs security.
Right.
It's not a job where you enter it at the entry level and you work and then you advance to middle management and you get raises and ultimately you become a vice president or a partner in a firm and, you know, move toward that gold watch and et cetera.
Imagine the security guys.
It'd be so secure.
Just be sad to do it that way. Et cetera.
You know, I mean, I've had a couple points of great success, and I've had points of tremendous failure where I thought my career was over. But and some people hit those points where their career is over, and they let their career be over. They stop. They're too discouraged. They can't sell a book anymore. you got to keep writing. You got to keep it, you know, because it'll change again, you know. But you got to keep plugging away and don't let yourself give up. So it's the people who really want to do it. I don't know. I don't think you, sometimes I don't think you choose writing. I think it's something you have to do.
Yeah, I tell people that with stand where they go, well, how do I start this? And I go, well, if you care about it, you'll just do it. And if it means something to you, you'll do it. And when you feel like you're failing, you'll do it anyway. And if you keep doing it, you're automatically ahead of like 90% of the people who do it. That there's just that, if you just did that, you might have a shot because most people will give up along the way.
Yeah.
I took some questions from Reddit. No, they're good questions. I didn't pick any wonky.
ASL. That's the first question.
Well, I started a subreddit last night because I couldn't figure out like where to get some question submissions from. Like, well, do I put it in the Game of Thrones thread? Do I put it in a writing thread or a subreddit? And so I created AMA. What did I create? AMATASE. Ask me anything to ask someone else. So it was a long way to go.
That's good,
but it works. I got a bunch of questions. This is from Batman Burry. It's Batman and then B-U-R-Y. It looks like Batman Burry. Like it's a
I don't know that Batman.
He's the British Victorian Batman.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Yeah. Hello, I'm Batman Burry. In a previous interview, you mentioned your belief that fantasy and science fiction are actually two sides of the same coin. Could you elaborate that idea for a moment? And talk a little bit about some sci-fi author books/books that influence you over your career.
Yeah, I think science fiction and fantasy, and also horror to some extent, are all subsets of what used to be called romantic fiction, as opposed to realistic fiction. These are the two main branches of fiction, and the only differences between them is the furniture. you know, spaceships and aliens, castles and knights, or dragons or whatever, or gothic haunted houses and vampires, you know, the imaginative elements, but...
Is that a polarizing point with some people who are on either side? Like, no, we're sci-fi, we're not fantasy, and vice versa? Or do you think everyone sort of feels that way?
No, it is a polarizing issue almost entirely from a science fiction side. there is a subset of science fiction authors who regard science fiction as, you know, the one true literature here, and fantasy is drivel because fantasy, you know, science fiction could happen and fantasy could not happen. You know, fantasy is made up silly stuff, and science fiction is real and relevant. You know, a lot of them can quote the famous Vonnegut speech from God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, where the Kilgore Trout or something breaks into the Milford Science Fiction Writers Conference and gives the famous speech about, you guys are the only ones writing about the future. You are the only ones writing about how our society is changing and what machines are doing to men and all of this stuff. And that speech, you know, oddly enough, coming written by a writer who himself did everything he could to distance himself from science fiction and not have that label put on his books, but that affirmation of the value of science fiction as this predictive literature that's dealing with real social problems in the real world has become a mantra to some science fiction writers. But the truth is, I don't like that kind of science fiction. I don't tend to read. I mean, I've read some, certainly. I've read all the classics of the genre. Something like John Brunner's The Sheep Look Up and Stand on Zanzibar in its day, which were very much about, you know, the social problems and things that were going on. But my favorite science fiction is like Jack Vance. It's you know, 1,000 years in the future on some weird planet with some crazy society and interesting aliens, you know, all the stuff... that Ty and Daniel Abraham are writing as James S. A. Corey about the solar system of the future, and Mars and Earth are at war, and there's strange alien artifacts being found. And that stuff is not very different from the science fiction that I wrote back when I was writing my Thousand World stories from fantasy. Instead of, you know, you have a spaceship instead of a dragon and all that, but you have aliens instead of elves, but... You know, there are no aliens, there are no elves. It's all romantic constructs, it's all imaginative fiction, as opposed to the realistic fiction where people are writing about the problems of a suburbanite you know, who's been passed over for a vice presidency and is having an affair with the next door neighbor.
Is he going to get the gold watch?
He went for the security.
Yeah.
He deserves the gold watch. This is from Seraphis, who wants to know, once Song of Ice and Fire is finished and that weight is lifted off your shoulders, what are you looking forward to the most? A new writing project, branching out into other media, or perhaps some well-deserved time off from writing?
You know, when I take time off for writing, it's like a couple weeks. I can't imagine ever retiring, you know. Even as long as my mind is still working, I've always made up stories. I think always make up stories. I have dozens of other stories unconnected with Ice and Fire that I want to tell. Which ones will I tell by the time Ice and Fire is finished? I have no idea. Whichever one I really want to tell at that date, and that's going to be, you know, 5, 7, 10 years in the future, and I'll be a different person by then. I'll probably have 100 ideas between now and then that I haven't even thought of now, so who knows?
Yeah.
But I will write something else. I will always continue, I think, to keep writing. It may be stuff that the Ice and Fire fans won't like, because it won't be Ice and Fire. It may be even like short stories. I began my career by writing a lot of short stories. I love the short story form. I don't write it much anymore. It doesn't pay very much, but it's still a great form. And by the time I finish Ice and Fire, which, given the success of it, has left me pretty well off financially, so I don't think I'm going to have to worry about, oh my God, I took a month and I'm only going to get $1,000 for it. I'll be able to afford to do that and still write. So I might write a bunch of short stories, but I don't know.
Is it harder for? Is the same level of difficulty short story versus like a long? You know, like a novel, in the sense that, you know, the short story is really kind of like a sketch. You have to convey the idea and kind of get in and get out. Is that more challenging in some aspects, or is it easier?
They're both hard in different ways. I mean, they're different skill sets. But, you know, you can write a short story in a white-hot heat of falling in love with the idea and the characters, and then it's over. You know, you spend a couple weeks on it. I mean, I've written short stories in as little as a week. Novels obviously take commitments of at least a year. It's always taken me at least a year to write a novel, and with Ice and Fire, you know, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, so it's a long thing.
That's weird, because you would change. You personally would change in a period of time that you're writing something. Yes. So do you get 2 or 3 years in, like 300 pages in, and then you're like, I hate this now? Or like you're different, or you don't believe some of the things you wrote anymore?
But that is an issue. I mean, years ago, I was in, when I lived in Chicago, I was in a writing group with Gene Wolfe, brilliant writer. And Gene, in our writers group, we were seeing the early drafts of what began as a novella and ultimately became Gene's famous 4-book trilogy, The Shadow of the Torturer, and its sequels, Shadow of Torturer, Claw of Conciliator, you know, Citadel of the Autark, etc. Gene was a full-time magazine editor for Plant Engineering magazine. That's how he supported himself and his family. He wrote weekends, he wrote nights, but the crucial part was he didn't have to pay his bills with his money from writing. So he wrote that entire series before anyone saw any of it. He wrote all 4 books.
Oh, wow.
In first draft. And then when he finished them, by the time he finished book 4, he knew exactly where it was going, and he could go back and revise book 1 with book 4 already in mind, and, you know, put in some foreshadowing to things that would happen in book 3 that he hadn't been thinking when he wrote book 1, take out some things that turned out to be dead ends that never led to anywhere or whatever, and produce that. And that's the ideal way to write a long series, is to write the entire thing and then submit it only when it's done. But, of course, I would have starved to death if I'd done that thing, because my writing is my only source of income, and you know, around, if since I started this in 91 and I'm still working on it all these years later, I would have had no income for, you know, 25 years here, so that would have been difficult for me.
Sure.
But artistically, that's the ideal way to go about it.
Are there things that you look back with the original Game of Thrones and you're like, shit, I wish I hadn't done that?
Yeah, there are.
were you able to influence maybe a change in that when it came to the series? Like, it's like, you know what, I kind of, there's a thing that I would have liked to do. Do you mind doing that for the series?
Well, I've thrown a few things like that at David and Dan from time to time. But I hesitate to mess with it too much because, you know, it is what it is. I published the books. It's too late to change. I know some writers go back and they revise their earlier books. You know, Arthur C. Clarke published his first novel, yeah, Against the Fall of Night, and then he went back later and rewrote it as The City and the Stars. Both interesting books. It's interesting to look at them and see the differences. I actually prefer the earlier book, however.
Yeah.
I like Against the Fall of Night better than The City and the Stars. So sometimes your first instinct is your right instinct.
You hear that, George Lucas?
Yeah. Oh, he loves to listen to the podcast.
Sure, yeah.
He's really going to take that to heart.
Yeah. No, he didn't hear it. No matter how many times people
George,
try.
George!
Joshua Quayle wants to know, essentially his question is, you've become so accustomed to character death, which can be hard for your fan, you're a fan, like, to watch, you know, like, it's basically someone that they get to know that then all of a sudden dies. And so, emotionally, this guy's question sort of revolves around how He has emotional difficulty now being attached to characters because he knows they might die. So his has shifted to the sources of power behind the players. And was that by design or incidental? Or what's your overall take on killing a character?
Well, my overall take is more people should do it, I guess. I mean, that's weird that you can't get attached to characters because you know you must die. I mean, does he carry that through into real life and not get attached to the people around him because they might die?
Probably.
They will die. All of them will die. I hate to tell you guys this, but all of you are going to die.
Not us.
Comic-Con 2013! Let's just jump out the window, guys, together!
We are the champions, my friend. That is true. You know, somewhere right now at Comic-Con 2013, every one of those people, those 150,000 people, is going to die. There will come a time when nobody living will remember Comic-Con 2013.
That's not possible, the times we're having.
We still form, you know, that's part of the wonder of the human race is life and death, and we form these attachments, and we lose people, and we find new people, and you know, we live these lives in, I don't know, defiance of the darkness that looms over us all. And winter is coming for every one of us.
You should write all that down. That was good. You should write that shit down.
I know, it's not snappy. Probably not aware.
Do you get excited? There must be some kind of a weird thrill in knowing that you've hooked someone into a character and they're like, oh, just you wait.
Actually, it's hard for me to kill the characters. I mourn them almost as I do real people. But even some of the villains sometimes, as nasty as they may be, and they perform an important plot function. And when you lose one, it's hard to replace them sometimes. But you know, I'm a reader before I'm a writer, and they say you write the stories that you want to read, and I think there's an element of truth to that. And as a reader and as someone who goes to a lot of movies and television shows, read comic books, I like things to be unpredictable. I hate these things where, you know, you read the first chapter, you know exactly where the book is going to go, it's completely predictable. And I want the suspense of knowing that my characters are risking things and so forth.
So my final question is about how do you push past the wall, you know, when you sit down and you know...
The wall of ice.
When you sit down and you know, like, I need to write today, I have to get through today, but your brain is just sort of on lockdown. Do you step away or are you able to mash through it? And how do you do that?
You know, some days I'm able to mash through it, some days I'm not. That's one of the things. I mean, I work pretty much every day. The only time that I take off whole days are when I'm traveling, and that's a different sort of work, like I'm doing here. Or, you know, during NFL season when I'm watching my football games on Sunday, I take all Sunday off. But other than that, I'm working pretty much 7 days a week, but I'm not always necessarily writing. Some days I do hit the wall, and I'll answer email. I mean, I'm presently about 3,000 emails behind, and, you know, I may come a day where I get the writing is just not coming very well, so, you know, okay, I'll answer 100 emails today. And
got a lot of emails from George today. Oh, he must not be writing.
Yeah.
What's a good
I
word
count? Minions like Ty and his associates here who are trying to take some of the emails and some of the associated things off my plate, but things keep piling up on my plate.
What's a good word count for you in a day where you feel like, oh, I got a good, or is it, I hit a good story point, or is there like a metric of a word count that you like to hit?
If I'm perfectly happy if I'm doing like 4 or 5 pages a day, that's a great day for me. I've had a day, occasional days where I've written 20 pages. That's probably the record I've ever had in my entire life, but it's only happened like twice.
Yeah.
And it tends to happen toward the end of a book, you know, like on something like Fever Dream, Armageddon, Rag, where the end was in sight. I was on the last chapters, and suddenly I'm going downhill, and it's all falling into place that I'm building. I haven't reached that stage on Ice and Fire yet here, because there's still so much more to go. So,
So Skin Trade is out. It's coming out. Is it out? Is Skin Trade out yet? Or is
the comic?
Yeah.
It should have debuted here.
Yeah, it debuted here at Comic-Con.
It debuted nationally yesterday, so presumably it's selling it in the Avatar booth right now.
And then Meat House Man is October, right?
Yes.
Meat House Man is October. And then georgerrmartin.com. I notice you've never tweeted. You do have a Twitter account with a bunch of followers, but there are 0 tweets on it.
I don't tweet.
Don't tweet.
I'm not on Twitter. My minions have set up things. I guess I have. What do I have? Do I have a Twitter account? Or is that some fake account?
Yulio set one up for you that...
Okay.
You have a shit ton of followers, but you're not following anyone. There's no tweets. They're just waiting. Please, just one tweet. You just tweet the whole novel. Just one tweet, 140 characters at a time. And then there's essentially a non-writing, you're not a blog, which is your live journal, which is more about like sportsy and just anything that's not the sci-fi fantasies.
Well, I talk about writing there and all of that stuff, but, I talk about anything there, about football during football season and trips I'm taking or whatever, just things that concern me. I did one on old movie theaters recently because I bought a movie theater, which I'm in the process of
in New Mexico,
restoring.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to reopen it in August. So
who's your team, football-wise?
Giants and the Jets. It's good to have two. The Jets, of course, are the cross I have to bear. But
I'm a Patriots fan, so I don't care for either of your teams.
fight! Let's do it outside. Come on, Martin. No offense, Matt, but he's got a way cooler.
Well, you crush the Jets twice a year, and usually humiliate us, and then like the Big Brother, the Giants come and spank you in the street.
They're actual Giants. Sir, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for letting us come to your hotel room.
Right? My pleasure.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Awesome.
Great.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Rhea Seehorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.